I count it as a great privilege to be here, and one of the greatest privileges is having Ross Hafner lead a prayer for me. I've had the privilege of going to school here with his father, and when Ross was about this tall, I guess, and it was a wonderful time to be around that family, and I've had the even greater privilege of watching him and his brother and sister grow up, and they're fine Christians, and I'm blessed to have them as my friends, and I'm glad that you have Russell coming this evening as a speaker. He's a tremendous man and has made a tremendous family as well. We've all probably settled in just a little bit after lunch. You know, the food is pretty good. Still got a little bit of aftertaste, but what would it be like to have an ice cream sundae right now? Wouldn't that be great? Now let me ask you something. How much would you pay for an ice cream sundae? And this is not just anyone. We're talking, you know, 3 scoops of succulent Turkish vanilla ice cream that has been infused with Madagascar vanilla and drizzled with the world's most expensive, rarest, finest chocolates available. How much would you pay? $8? Would you pay $8 for that sundae? $10? Would you pay $25 for that ice cream sundae? What about $100? How about $250? Would you pay $250 for that sundae? Well, let me tell you something. If you did, you couldn't even buy that cup that the ice cream's in. This is Serendipities of New York's Golden Opulence Sundae, recorded in Guinness Book of World Record as the most expensive ice cream sundae available. For $1,000, you can sit down and enjoy this ice cream sundae. Each scoop is individually wrapped in 23-karat gold edible foil. Parisian dried fruits of the rarest sorts are tucked in around the sides. Flowers are sculpted of sugar and covered over with a bronze coating that is also edible. And as the finishing touch, a scoop of unsalted caviar infused with passion fruit. And you get to keep the $350 Beckford Crystal goblet as a testimony to your insanity. In America, we know how to live with wealth. We are a society that seems consumed with finding the latest and the greatest, the most expensive, the best in the that the world could possibly give to us. But today, we want to find out not how to live wealth, but how can we live with Christ and with wealth at the same time. How can we merge a life of Christianity and sincerity toward God, of serving our Savior, and at the same time holding on to certain things in this life that are considered as wealthy, as luxury items? Is it possible to do these things? I'm reminded of Paul's admonition in 1 Timothy, beginning in chapter 6, beginning in verse 9. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves through with many pangs. These words of Paul set the stage for the dire straits of wealth and riches on this earth. The love of money has, and the desire to have it all, has destroyed families. It has divided churches. It has decimated souls for centuries. And let me tell you, the current trend of materialism that saturates our society indicates that our century will not be spared from the fate of greed. As parents begin to pass on their passion for the love of money and the desire for lucrative gain to their children when they are but infants. Paul's warnings reflects the words of Jesus just a generation earlier, when Jesus, speaking to them, said, "How difficult is it for them that trust in riches to enter the kingdom of God? It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich person to enter in the kingdom of heaven. And of course, James's admonition in James 5, verse 1, the opening verse of our text at this hour. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming up on you. These passages, if we really think about it, bring up a wealth of questions, as it were. For example, is wealth inherently sinful? Is having a lot of money, making a large salary, something that is intrinsically sinful in and of itself? Or the question, can Christians have money? Or maybe modify that, can Christians have a lot of money? And if it is possible, how can we live Christ and wealth at the same time? So we begin our exposition of James chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. Understand that the entire chapter really is identifying different afflictions that we have. For example, our section in James 1, or 5, 1 through 6, is affliction from wealth. That our monies can be part of what troubles our lives. But it's not the only thing. In verses 7 through 12, he gives us affliction from persecution. That is, people who are around us who don't like us or don't like the things that we believe, and therefore persecute us for our faith and for who we are as Christ's children. In verses 13 through 15, he deals with afflictions that we might have through sickness when our bodily health is taken away from us. And then the last section, verses 16 through 20, is afflictions that arise from sin. And in all of this, we go back and we're going to look at our section in verses 1 through 6. And it's going to divide itself, I believe, into three easy sections that we can understand, each dealing with wealth and how it relates to people. More specifically, how it relates to us. Let us begin by looking, first of all, at the attitudes of wealth. Our attitudes toward the wealth that we might gain. James begins by calling out to those who are rich. In verse 1, he says, come now, you rich. Weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. A lot of times, we go back and we look at this phrase, come now. Or as the King James says, go to now. But it's the idea of gathering attention, of snapping everyone's eyes and ears to this particular place. James is calling on them to gather around and listen up, because what we are about to say is important. It is something that every single one of us needs to know about God, about Christ, about the Spirit, and about our relationship to the three. Come now, you who are rich. And immediately our mind jumps to those who are really rich, CEOs of companies or sports stars with $10 million contracts plus endorsements. And we say, that's the rich. Me, I'm not rich. The word rich simply refers to those who have an abundance or a fullness of possessions. You have a lot of things. Over the last 2 years, we have been going through our house and getting things ready for the garage sale. Don't you love garage sales? I hate them. Hate them with a passion. My wife can tell you, I gave her such a hard time. I said, you know, you owe me rent for storing all this junk in my bedroom until the garage sale. We finally had it. And we had so much stuff and we got rid of it. Oh, and I was so happy we finally got rid of so much stuff. Because we had an abundance of possessions. In America, we like to call attention to the three tiers of wealth, you know, the upper, middle, and lower class, you know. And while everyone does fit in those places, understand that nearly everyone, if not everyone, in the United States qualifies as rich under James's definition here. You don't have to be Bill Gates or Michael Jordan. You've only got to be you. Do you have a house to go home to? I don't care how dilapidated it might be. If you have a roof over your head, if you have another change of clothing other than what you're wearing right now, you're among some of the wealthiest people in the world. If you have luxuries like a can opener or a pair of tweezers or a lectureship book, brethren, you're rich. And when James says, come now, you rich, he's talking to you. He's talking to me. This is his audience. And he says, come gather round. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to weep and howl. The idea of weep is the idea of mourning. He tells them to weep. And how, A.T. Robertson in his Word Pictures of the New Testament talks about how the first word, weep, is the beginning of the crying, and the howling comes in to intensify the action of the crying. Have you ever seen someone cry in a silent way? They're silently sobbing there and their shoulders shake, but you might only hear a small whimper out of them. Have you ever heard those who, when they weep, wail out loud? Oh! That's the type, James says, we, the rich, need to be doing. And there's a twofold purpose, I believe, behind the weeping, behind this weeping that is intensified by the howling. And it begins with a need to be heard. And two people need to hear it. Number one, the rich people. We need to hear ourselves weeping and howling because miseries are coming. They're in the process of getting here to us. And he says, weep and howl. And I think it's for us to be reminded of the dangers of wealth. That having a lot of money can be dangerous to our souls if we don't have the right attitudes toward it. So he calls upon us, you weep, you howl, you listen to those things. And then it is also for, on the other side, it is for people around the rich so that they also might be warned of how bad things can be. So you have the rich need to weep and howl to remind themselves, and they need to weep and howl to warn others. Paul Simon wrote a song by the title Richard Cory. Some of you may have remembered that from years gone by. Richard Cory was a banker's only son. Had all the money in the world. Had everything that he could possibly want. The song is sung from the perspective, however, of one of his factory workers. And he talks about how great Richard Cory is and how happy he must be. And he says, "But I curse the life that I'm living because I work in his factory. I'm a nobody." And he wishes that he could be Richard Cory. Isn't that how it is a lot of times? You see people with a lot of money, and then there's the group over here that envies them because they're lots of money. In the end of the song, Richard Cory goes and commits suicide. And the factory worker, you know what he says? "I still wish I was Richard Cory." Do you see how attitudes toward wealth can decimate the rich, decimate the poor? It tears us all apart. We go back and recall the words of Jesus, and we begin to understand the reason is the attitude toward money itself. Remember what he said, "How difficult is it for them that trust in riches?" Mark 10:24-25. They have trusted in their riches, and it's difficult for them to get into heaven. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away. 1 Timothy 6:9-10 again. Notice what they said. Jesus said, "They that trust in their riches." Notice these attitudes. Someone who says to their riches, "That money is going to save me. That money is going to make me a better person. That money is going to buy me what I want. That money is going to make a better life for me." And we begin to trust in the riches to do for us what only God can do for us. Paul talks about those who desire to be rich. They sit at home and scheme and think up ways to get richer, to have more money, because they want more and more and more. He calls it the love of money and even refers to their craving. Almost like some of you now are craving that Sunday, wishing you had $1,000 to drop on it. You're craving, you desire, you want it so badly. I think of what Solomon warns us in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. When he says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money." That is, if you are living to have a little bit more money, when you get that little bit more money, you know what's going to happen? You're going to want some more. And you're going to want more. And you're going to want more. And your life will be consumed and depressing because of your pursuit of money. "Nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity." And if you look in Ecclesiastes 5, we're not going to take the time to go all the way through the chapter. That's not our text. But he talks about wealth and how wealth will not bring us power, in verses 8 and 9, that it will not bring us satisfaction, in verse 10 and 11, that it will not bring to us peace, in chapter or verse 12. In 13 and 14, it will bring us no joy, it will bring us no hope, and it will bring us no companionship, and ultimately, it will not bring us eternal life. The wealth of Solomon's wisdom shines forever and ever. So James admonishes those with these sinful attitudes towards wealth. But you know, his words are not just for those who have that attitude. It is also for the poor that might have that attitude. It's for the rich that might have a righteous attitude toward money, that they don't fall into the same trappings of the money itself. No doubt Solomon, or Paul, had these very words of Solomon in mind. The overall message in verse 1, I think, is very clear. If you hang your hat of happiness on the peg of materialism, you can expect that it'll fall to the floor. It'll get dented up, it'll get dirty, and it will be unused. Materialism is a plague. A plague that seeks to convince men that the world's resources belong to them, when in reality they're all on loan from God. Materialism doesn't solve problems, brethren. It creates them. And it takes the God of heaven and a loving Him to come back and fix the mess that materialism creates. So be aware, number one, that God is concerned about our attitudes toward wealth. And if we are going to live Christ with wealth, we must have a proper, respectful attitude toward wealth, because it does affect our destiny. Number two, though, in verses 2 through 4, he talks about the acquisition of wealth. How are we getting the money that we have? Hopefully that we have the proper attitude toward. First, he deals with those who, in verses 2 and 3, are hoarding wealth. There's two ways that he identifies here. And the first one is that of hoarding wealth. In verse 2 and 3, he says, your riches have rotted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You've laid up treasures in the last days. They have closed their hearts to others. They've looked upon their own wealth and they said, this is mine, much like the foolish man in Luke chapter 12. I'll tear down these barns, I'll build bigger barns. Oh, what a time we'll have. We can sing and dance around the big barns that I'll have. Oh, he was so happy. Until God, of course, came and said, you fool. Tonight your soul is required of you. These are people that have no joy. You know, the things we teach in Vacation Bible School, joy, Jesus first, others second, yourselves last. They have yaj. Yourself first, others if there's any left, and then Jesus if I happen to think about him. They have no joy because they're hoarding their wealth close to their chest, not wanting that it would go anywhere. But you know, our hearts must be open to those who are in need all around us. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 4 tells us explicitly that we're to have others' welfares upon our minds and upon our hearts, just as Jesus did. That we follow in His example. But even under the Jewish system, there was ample law about how the Jews were supposed to take care of those who were poor and in need. Things like you couldn't harvest the corners of your field. If you left a sheaf that had been gathered, and when you put everything else in the barn, you looked out there and there was already a sheaf that had been left behind, you had to leave it for the poor and the strangers that might pass through the land. If you harvested the crop one time and then there were still some unripe fruit there, and you wanted to come back later and reharvest, do a second harvest, you couldn't do it. You had to leave it. If you loaned money to someone and in exchange they gave you their cloak, you had to give it back to him by nightfall. I mean, God had, he said, you take care of one another. It was imperative that they take care of one another. And it's the same way even today in the New Testament. In Matthew 5:42 says, give to the one who begs from you and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Don't consider whether or not he's going to be able to pay it back. If he's in need, we have to open our hearts and help. That's the picture that is painted for the Christian, the one who has repented and changed his life. Ephesians 4:28, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. It was a given as Christians that we were going to give to those in need. That we were going to share out of the abundance of our wealth with those who needed it. In James's estimation, some rich people tend to hoard their wealth, unwilling to share it with the poor and with the needy or for whatever reason. Their riches, like their gold, their silver, their food, their grains, their land, their clothing, anything like this, he says, James paints the picture that it's become corrupt. Greed causes people to keep their own resources to themselves, not willing to spread it out. And as a result, their food begins to rot. Their clothes become moth fodder. Even the coins rust, become corroded because of a lack of use. In this world that we live in, giving to the poor may seem like bad business sense. But in the sight of God, not giving to the poor is bad spiritual sense. We need to be helping those who are around us. Rich people often give up their souls to gain the whole world, only to lose it all in the end. Mark 8:36. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? There's no gain there. And as the grains decay in the barn and the coins rust in the jar and the food rots in the pantry, James sees something else getting corrupted. Their flesh. He uses this figurative imagery of how they are consumed like a raging fire. It's being torn down and devoured. The image is clear. It is greed consumes the man as the man consumes with greed. And it's an ugly picture. He says, "You have heaped up treasures together for the last days," verse 3. People like to save their money. They hoard it up for that rainy day affair, for retirement, or for whatever. You know, they're hoarding up their monies. And they see someone in need, they say, "Well, you know, I'm saving for retirement. I'd help you, except, you know, all this extra money, that's for my retirement whenever I quit working." And they have all sorts of reasons about why they cannot do it. James says, "You're piling up in anticipation for the judgment day. And what's going to happen is your mound of wealth is going to become the primary witness to testify against you. It is going to grow a voice on that day, and it's going to say to the Father on the judgment day, 'God, you can't let this one through because he kept his wealth to himself.'" There's going to be two mounds there that day, though. The first mound is the mound of your money that's going to be the primary witness against you. In Romans 2:5, tells us the other mound is God's wrath. He says, "You treasures up to yourselves the wrath against the day of wrath." God's wrath is there. So you have two mounds, one of wrath and one of money, and they're both telling God, "Don't let this one in. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you." No doubt, James had the judgment day in mind when he spoke those words. You know, of the ways that God authorizes us to acquire money, hoarding wealth is not one of them. Defrauding others is not the other one. And yet that's what James deals with in verse 4. He talks of those. He says, "Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. Behold, witness these things. The very money which you thought, 'Well, hey, this is great. You know, I've got a little extra money in my pockets.' Yeah, you got it in your pockets because you stole it from the guy you were supposed to pay." And he says it is kept back from you by fraud. And notice, the money here again is crying out. Personified once again, crying out against you as a witness. And who hears the cry? God, but not just God, the Lord of hosts. Uses an old Hebraism. The King James translates it as the Sabaoth, but it was the armies. It's what the Old Testament would refer to as the armies of the Lord, or the Lord of hosts. In other words, the cries, the desperate cries and the pleas for the injustice that has just been just her or been done, he says that those cries go out to God, who with his armies is going to enforce justice against the rich, against those who have defrauded. Notice that the money was owed to them, though. These are laborers who mowed your field. These aren't slaves. These are people that the owner of the land went and contracted with them, said, hey, if you'll come and mow down the grain and gather it up and put it in the barns for me, you know, I will pay you X amount of dollars. They said, okay, we'll do it. We'll come harvest your fields. And they went and they harvested. They did a great job, apparently. And instead of paying them, he comes back and he says, you know what? I decided I'm not going to pay you after all. Can you imagine how much easier it would be to make ends meet in our families if we could just take every penny we ever earned and not pay any expenses? You know, just go down through the grocery store, la-di-da-di-da, get your groceries, push your cart on out to the car, throw everything in and drive off as quickly as possible before they came out after you. I mean, that's a bunch of free food, man. You know, if someone comes and mows your yard, don't pay them. When the water bill sends, or when the water company sends you the bill for how much water have you used, don't pay it. Can you imagine how much extra money you would have in your pants pocket? if you didn't have to pay your expenses. And yet we can see the folly in that. Fraud may increase the profit margin, but it's theft. The Bible does tell us how we can acquire money. It says we can work for it, Romans 4:4. We can receive it as a gift, 2 Corinthians 8:4. We can find it in a field, and if we can't find the owner, then Matthew 13:14 or 44-46 tells us, you know, if you find the treasure in a field, you know, cover it up and go and buy the field so you can have the treasure. If you find the pearl of great price, you get to keep it. If you inherit money from your parents, like the prodigal son did in Luke 15, this is how the Bible authorizes us to receive money. Hoarding and frauding is not in that list. And that's why he tells us to be careful how we acquire our money, because how we acquire money is going to impact our eternal destiny, just like our attitudes toward wealth. And then number 3, verses 5 and 6, the application of wealth. God is concerned about how we use our wealth. In fact, he goes into this verse. He says, you have lived on the earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. In verse 6, you have condemned, you have murdered the righteous person, and he does not resist you. In other words, God is concerned about what you do with your money after you get it. Instead of spending their cash wisely, these people that are addressed by James, they make poor decisions with their money, like a lot of Americans do. We may not make the decisions that hurt others the way these people seem to do, but we certainly make poor decisions. First of all, in the ways of acquisition or application, they spend it on themselves. They wanted an extravagant item, they went and bought it. If they wanted to patronize a prostitute, they did it. If they wanted a slave, they purchased them. Anything that their hearts desired, that's what they took. Or that's what they bought. All their money was consumed on self, with no compassion and no thought of those outside. It reminds me of the people in the days of Amos, the prophet. Hear this word, you kind of Bashan, that dwell in the mountains of Samaria. He tells them, or he speaks of them, he says, who say to their husbands or their lords, bring that we may drink. They oppress the poor, they crush the needy, they trust in themselves. And when it comes right down to it, what are they doing? They're sitting, they're reclining, and they say, I think I'll have some lemonade. Bring my lemonade so I can drink and have fun. Bring and let me drink. And their reclining attitude is one that is destroying their hearts and their lives from the inside out. James uses this imagery of the fattened animal for slaughter. One time I was up in Kansas, and they have a lot of finishing lots up there. hundreds of steers, cattle, just in the pens, and they're packed in there, and they're feeding them all this food, and they're fattening the animals. You know why? Because when you start fattening an animal, you realize it's good for nothing else. They're not healthy enough to have to have offspring. They're not pretty enough anymore for showing. They're good for one thing, slaughter. They're fattening them up to be slaughtered. James says you are fattening your heart for the day of judgment. On that day, your life, your soul will be slaughtered at the judgment before the throne of God. Decimated. Good for only one thing. Utility grade meat. Dog food. There's no value in a life that has hoarded wealth to this much and has indulged themselves to the point where they are fattening their hearts for their own destruction. The second way that he identifies that they have applied their wealth is through corrupting justice. He tells them that you've condemned and you've murdered the righteous ones. Now the question some have said is, wondering if he's talking about Jesus. Have they condemned and murdered the righteous one? Now obviously Jesus is the righteous one. He was unjustly condemned. He was murdered. But I don't think that James is actually talking specifically about Jesus so much as he's saying that there are innocent people, that you're corrupting justice against them. You're using your wealth in a way that is taking power from those who need it. They no longer have the advocate. Have we ever seen justice perverted by money? In a perfect world, they say, justice will be a great balance. And yet in our society, cash seems to tip the scale sometimes, doesn't it? If you have enough publicity, enough money, enough expert witnesses, even the most guilty person can be acquitted of a crime that he committed. Likewise, or on the other hand, if you have no money, no one but a public defender, no expert witnesses, not enough money to do anything with, it's very possible that an innocent man can be convicted for a crime he did not commit. And what changes the balance? It was the money. And it's been this way for centuries. But you know, there is a day coming when all of those who are wrongly accused or sentenced, and all of those who are wrongly acquitted, will balance out again. That's on God's day of judgment. As the power of riches and wealth is often seems insurmountable, especially to the little guy. And this prompts James to say that last phrase, he does not resist you. He looks at the system and he says, there's nothing I can do. And he gives in to the injustice that is humanity. How we feel about our wealth, how we get our wealth, how we use our wealth, all of these are things that God cares about. There's just a couple of lessons, though, I want to look at from this and from other passages about living Christ and wealth. First, wealth comes from God. James 1:17, a verse that's already been studied. Most of us know by heart that every good gift and perfect gift comes down from above, from the Father of lights, in whom is no variableness. Proverbs 24:1 tells us, the earth is the Lord's, the fullness thereof, the world, and all them that dwell in it. Everything belongs to God, and in fact, He is giving it to us out of His blessings. I was reading a book a few weeks ago, Living Our Life Well Lived by Tommy Nelson. It's a study of the book of Ecclesiastes. And in the book, he asked this question. Have you ever considered that one of God's greatest mercies toward you is that He restricts how much money you do make? You know, a lot of us, we know, if God has given us a lot of money, those are great blessings. But you realize if God has withheld money from us, that's also a blessing. Maybe we're not strong enough to handle the wealth that might come our way otherwise. I thought that was an interesting thought to the fact that wealth comes from God in the first place. Sometimes even wealth that is held back from our hands. Number two, wealth should glorify God every time, everywhere. Paul said, "This I say, he which sows sparingly shall also reap sparingly, and he that sows bountifully shall reap bountifully." 2 Corinthians 9:6. God gives us power to enjoy our wealth. Ecclesiastes 6:2. Eat, drink, and enjoy the fruits of our labor. But everything that we do with our wealth should glorify God. I want you to compare two men. The first man buys a flashy car with personalized license plate. He has the opulent home. He has the engraved pearl and platinum silverware in the house. Friends and families know, everyone around him knows, that nobody is more important to this man than himself. The second man makes the same amount of money. He, on the other hand, has a modest home, nice home, nothing to say, "Oh, that's a bad home." It's a nice home. Drives a decent car. You know, but he also supports two different missionaries and a preaching student, Joe. He supports a preaching student here. This same man, besides that, his weekly contribution makes up about 30% of the total church's collection. He showers gifts on his family and on his friends and everyone around him. Everyone knows that everyone is more important to this man than himself. Question, which one glorified God with the gifts they had received? Number three, we need to put the spiritual matters and concerns over material concerns. We understand this. Jesus encouraged us in Matthew 6:19-21 to lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven. But I want you to think about Matthew 19 when the rich young man came to Jesus and approached him with the questions, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said, "If you will be made whole," or "if you will enter into life, keep the commandments." Matthew 19:17. This man, it seems that he knew that that's what Jesus was going to say, because he answered, "So that's what I've been doing." You know, inwardly, you can tell he's happy, he's thrilled. "All right, I'm in like Flynn, because that's what I've been doing." And then Jesus tailors the rest of his message. "But if you..." And I can almost see Jesus pointing at him, because this part was just for him. "If you will be perfect, if you will be spiritually mature, if you will be complete, go and sell everything that you have and give to the poor. You shall have a treasure in heaven." And we read that and our hearts break as we watch the young man turn away from Jesus, being more in love with his money than his soul. We need to put spiritual things over the material things of this life. And finally, the lesson will be yours: be fair and just in your business dealings. I'm reminded of Psalm 15, verse 4, of those who swear to their own hurt. They make a pact, find out later that it's going to cost them a little bit more money. It's going to hurt them, maybe physically or emotionally. Yet they will keep their promise, even when it hurts them. Christians need to stand out like a Hummer in a parking lot full of Cooper Minis. We need to stand out as being known for our honesty, especially in public dealings. We're not the ones that are looting during outages. We're not the ones who think that the extra $5 the clerk gave back to me by accident is a good thing. We're the people who go in and give the $5 back. When we point out, they say, "You charged me a dollar less than what the sign said." It's honest dealings, even when it means our own hurt. No, wealth is not inherently sinful. In fact, any amount of wealth is a gift from God, and if it were sinful, then it is God that would be contributing to our sinfulness of wealth. So wealth obviously is not sinful in and of itself. It is how we view it, how we use it, and how we get it that makes it bad. Most of us are rich. Most of us have been blessed by God in ways that we can't even be thankful for enough times. The fact is, as long as we accumulate wealth through authorized ways and means and activities, through their acquisition, we'll be acceptable to God. As long as we as Christians use our wealth to glorify God, support our families and the church, and aid those who are in need, the application of our wealth will be acceptable to God.